This Sunday at 3 p.m. on Youth Speaks Out, we will discuss the political climate today. We will be voting age soon, and we'll talk about our expectations.
They stole a few elections, still we the people won. We voted out corruption, big corporations. We voted for an end to war.
What is authentic in our political system? That's Youth Speaks Out this Sunday at 3 p.m.
Welcome to Youth Speaks Out, a show by, for, and about young people. It airs on the first Sunday of each month from 3 to 4 p.m. and is hosted by young people in Mendocino County. We want to create a place where young people can talk truthfully about important issues in our lives and have a dialogue with a community of listeners. Today's hosts are me, Casey,
Aron,
and Elwin.
We are all seniors in Willits High School. All three of us will be old enough to vote in this fall's presidential election. We are conscientious citizens and want to make informed decisions about who to vote for. While we will certainly be influenced by our parents and friends, our decisions will be based on information that we personally gather. A large proportion of the American news coverage these days concerns the Republican primary elections. The news is often referred to in terms used in sports and racing events. The excitement of the campaign certainly increase the market share for the media. However, actual information about the candidate's character and beliefs is what is essential for the voters. It is expected that between $6 and $7 billion will be spent this year promoting candidates in federal and state elections. In January 2010, the Supreme Court's Citizens United ruling lifted restrictions on how much money corporations, unions, and individuals could spend on political ads. But corporations and unions cannot give money directly to a presidential committee. Instead, they give money to a super PAC. They're political action committees closely associated with particular candidates, and often run by friends and former staffers of the candidates they support. But unlike candidates' committees, whose contributions are limited by federal law, super PACs can take donations of any size. This is the first presidential election in which super PACs have existed. The rise of the super PACs has completely reinvented the dynamics of negative campaigning, removing the consequences of factual inaccuracy by allowing the candidate a veneer of deniability. In Europe, there are carefully regulated limits on campaign financing, as well as limits to the length of the campaigns and restrictions on advertising. For example, in France, the limit that a presidential candidate can spend on the campaign is 20 million euros. That is less than 3% of what we will spend on the campaign to re-elect President Obama. Also, campaign advertising on French television is forbidden, but official time is given to the candidates on public TV. We will discuss these matters in more depth later. As newcomers to the electoral process, we have a fresh view of the world of politics. We know that most politicians are at least the age of our parents, and many are the age of our grandparents. The overwhelming majority are white males, though we have the first non-white president of the United States. In studying history, we have learned that there have been great political leaders who have made our country a fairer, more democratic union, and we also learned about the corruption, greed, and inequality promoted by leaders who are the puppets of the elite, the industries, and corporations. What we want to discuss today is how the political climate appears to us. We care about our country and its role in both local and worldly affairs. We care about authenticity in politics. We want leaders who will carefully consider decisions that will affect us today and in the future. And, given that we will outlive most of them, we want the future given thoughtful consideration. We want to consider whether our electoral process is serving our political will in the best way it can. Are we being sold candidates by the same advertising companies that sell us fast food? Is accumulating the largest campaign financing the key to being elected? Are we voting for the best promotions or the best candidates? We will discuss these topics for 30 to 40 minutes, then we will open the phone lines for your insights and questions. We are in the Willits studio, and the phone number will be 707-456-9991. We will open those phones in about 20 to 30 minutes. Elwin, how would you describe the political climate we are living in?
Well, I would say that our current political climate is heavily focused on the Obama problem. People are far too concerned with the country's upcoming election and not on actual issues such as the national debt. If the United States were to actually focus on things like this, we'd probably be better off as a country. And I believe that we really are going in the wrong direction with our election process, and we should try and fix it. Other countries like Germany have different systems in the U.S. They tend to have more relaxed standards on their disclosure policies and things like that. In Germany, they actually have a limit to broadcasting commercials. It limits them to 1 month of commercials and a total of 12 minutes for each candidate to present themselves on the broadcast media. No spending is allotted. Excuse me. Spending is allotted from the national government to the actual candidates from their parties, and money is allocated from the year previous to their campaigns. It's actually about 40% of a vote for a candidate will equal money, euros specifically. They cast two ballots.
I researched a little bit about the United Kingdom, and something that I'd like to see in the United States is transparency of where the money is coming from for the super PACs and anything that's financing any type of advertisement for a candidate. In the United Kingdom, there's the Representation of the People's Act, and that's about campaign financing and how they have to have transparency, and they have regulations on how much money a campaign can spend, which I found was approximately $42,000 per constituent being contested. So that amounts to about $26 million U.S. dollars. Some other research that I found is that the totals for what they're going to be spending in some of their elections is $126 million, which is considerably less than what is projected for this year's elections, which is $6 to $7 billion.
Now, I studied the French elections a little, and there's a lot of interesting stuff here. I mean, I think the one big difference between American and European presidential elections is here we call it the race. And I think that very accurately describes American politics, which is entirely different in Europe. I mean, here it truly is a race. It's each candidate scrambling for the most attention, scrambling for the best sound bites. And it seems very different in Europe, like, as I believe you two recently mentioned, is that rather than candidates paying as much money as they possibly can to get as many ads as possible, in France, in UK, and in Germany, instead they have a system where each candidate is given time by the government for free to advertise themselves on TV. So rather than, say, paying for the 30-second Super Bowl ad or something like that, you get an allotted time, like every other candidate, at the same network in the same situation. So rather than a race in which each candidate tries to put himself ahead of the other, they're simply given a certain amount of time to talk about themselves, to put out what they believe, and then the rest is left to the voters.
I'd say that it's a good system. Nowadays, you see political action committees making negative ads about, for example, someone who supports Gingrich has a negative ad about Romney, and vice versa, instead of focusing on what people really care about, which is what Gingrich or Romney are going to do if they are elected as presidents. What is their agenda? That's what I think, being a voter, is what I want to know. I don't care about what the other guy did wrong or what he's going to do. I want to know what he's thinking as to running the nation and getting us out of this financial crisis that we're in.
One thing is, in France, I believe it was 3 months prior to the elections, there are no ads run by the candidates. So really, it's no longer, in these countries, the media standing over your shoulder all the way up to the ballot booth like we have here. It really gives the people some space to make their own decision. And another nice thing, I believe this was in all three countries, politicians are allowed to only send you one thing in the mail. So rather than being spammed, as my family does, for, say, asking for campaign contributions to Obama, because we did contribute once to him, in Europe you'll get one envelope, and that is all. And it really removes some unnecessary pestering the candidates put on the people.
One of the more interesting things financially for Germany is that they actually have a hard cap on the amount of money that they can receive federally from their campaign. It's currently at 133 million euros, and they may not receive public annual funds than more publicly earned funds than they have the last year. Within the limits, they're actually allowed matching clauses within 3,300 euros. They receive 40% back from the government from their private earnings. So basically, they get an extra 40% on top of their private earnings. So that leads to more money for the candidates, although they are not allowed to actually air broadcast anything for except for a month before the election.
Another interesting thing is, in France, it's forbidden to estimate the results of the election before all the polling stations are closed. And I heard this used to be an issue in California, where the East Coast would start broadcasting results and estimating the election towards one politician or another. And the result would be is people in California would stop showing up, because if somebody already estimated that, say, Obama was going to win, then somebody voting against Obama might not bother voting in California, and somebody voting for him might not bother voting. So it really kind of skewed the elections and really gave somebody with an early lead an excessive favor.
Well, in the United Kingdom, something that's a bit different from here in the United States is that they don't have a set timetable for when the elections are going to be held. It's actually the prime minister who gets to make the decision of when the general election is going to happen. So, as to pertaining to the transparency that every political party has to have, anytime they're receiving a donation, they're going to want to be reporting it, because that's what the law is. And one of the things that I found interesting is that in one of the elections, the 2005 election, it was announced that they could begin campaigning April 4th of 2005, and the elections were held on May 5th. So that's a month of them knowing actually when the election was going to be. So it's a lot quicker notice than here in the United States, when they have a long time to prepare for a long campaign and to create negative ads. So in the United Kingdom, it's more about the reputation that they already carry as people that is going to carry them on, rather than how many negative campaigns they can buy about their opponents.
Now, to shift a little from the global view of things, I'd like to talk a little bit about the Electoral College. Here we have a system in which each state has electoral votes according to their population. So what happens is, when the majority of voters vote for a candidate in one of our states in a presidential election, then we have an electoral representative who goes out and is supposed to, but does not necessarily have to, vote for that candidate in a special electoral committee. And the problem here is, California is predominantly Democratic, and we have consistently voted Democratic in presidential elections. What happens then is, for minority Republican voters voting in California, their votes no longer apply, because the majority overrules them, and all of California's electoral votes, I believe 55, will go to a blue candidate. And also, that also hurts Democratic voters in California, because I will vote Democratic in this 2012 election, but in a way, my vote won't matter, because California was going to be blue anyway. The issue here is, to fix the electoral system, one would need a constitutional amendment, which is very difficult to pass. However, I believe it's Maine and Nebraska have a different system. The way their electoral votes work is, their electoral representative comes forth and votes a split vote depending on the percentage of votes in their state. So, say in Bush versus Al Gore, if 50% of Nebraskans voted for Al Gore and 50 for Bush, then their electoral representative would split his vote half for Bush and half for Gore, so everybody in that state was actually counted. And this, in fact, does not require a constitutional amendment, as that falls under state regulation of elections. So I feel that is a wonderful solution to the electoral issue.
Another thing that I think we need to have is standardization of voting booths. So that's one of the major controversies of the 2000 election. Was in Florida, they had something like a pin that would staple a hole in the paper, And then it was a huge controversy of what counted as a vote and what didn't. But what we need to do is nationally standardize. That way there's a certain, just a standard held to what a vote is. That way we avoid certain things like that, where it's actually left to the Supreme Court, which, I mean, some could argue that the ruling was fair, others that they wanted to revote, but that the Supreme Court has too much power over what's ultimately going to happen to the country.
It was a really interesting thing that happened in Florida during the elections between Bush and Gore. The elections were close, and there was accusations that things had gone wrong and that the votes had been counted incorrectly. So a recount of the votes was called for on the part of Al Gore. But the problem was the standards for how a vote counts were very vague and sketchy. There were things called hanging chads and so on, which means that when this hole was punched out of the paper to signify one's vote, sometimes the paper did not fall out. So, I mean, the question was, how can it really be counted as a vote, and at what point is this little paper being pushed out counted? So what happened was the Supreme Court stepped in, I believe on a Bush lawsuit against Al Gore for the recount, and said that because the standards were different for different people, like, say, in Florida, if you had a quote-unquote hanging chad, your vote would be counted. And say, in California, if you had a hanging chad, it wouldn't. And I believe it was under a constitutional clause of equal protection under the law that the Supreme Court ruled this recount unconstitutional. So obviously we needed a recount and things weren't clear, but because of the legal impracticality, the recount was thrown out and we ended up with a president that had lost the popular vote and really won under a lot of suspicious situations.
I'd like to kind of draw this to what's happening nowadays with the Republican candidates and, you know, what is what are they trying to push and what we think about what those candidates are of value and such. Casey, Elwin, what do you guys think?
I tend to think that the Republican candidates that have been put forth this year are a bit of a weak pool. I'm pretty sure that there's different Republicans out there that could have ran and gotten more popularity from the general population of the United States of America. And I just wanted to put one more thing on in the voting registration kind of thing. What counts as a vote is the only issue that I believe would come up with that is that if we were to, say, electronically run the votes, the problem would be that the company that made those machines could still have some sort of control over what they had.
I'd like to speak on the Republican presidential candidates. Honestly, I think it's a very, very weak turnout. I mean, you guys must remember Herman Cain really was pretty crazy and out there. I mean, he had his own ad where his campaign manager was smoking a cigarette in the commercial. I mean, that's really just shocking. And another thing he did was, in his resignation speech, he quoted the Pokemon movie from 2000. I mean, this is a children's movie, a cartoon, being quoted by a Republican presidential candidate who is seriously considered.
And I'm pretty sure it's not really the best thing for your candidacy if your main credential as a politician is the owner of, what was it, Godfather's Pizza?
Godfather Pizza, yes. And, I mean, all around we've seen some pretty weak showing, like Rick Perry wasn't sure what the third government organization he wanted to get rid of was, and then he had his strong campaign, which just completely bashed homosexuals and made a completely false assertion that children were being banned from praying in school, which isn't at all true.
Michelle Bachmann was a constitutionalist that didn't actually know the constitutional amendments and had a bit of a slant that didn't make too much sense.
And then you have Mitt Romney, who's a flip-flopping on the issues, and first he's pro-abortion and he's anti-abortion, and he just doesn't really know what he wants to do. So, you know, is he trying to just appeal to the audiences, or is he actually a genuine candidate whose views have evolved? But more focusing on what Romney has been pushing is against Obamacare, and it's ironic because the Obamacare, I believe, was actually drafted upon Romney's Massachusetts healthcare. So I find it quite ironic that Romney would be so heavily swayed against it, considering that it's based upon one of his own programs that he did as a governor.
Now, I'd like to bring my own opinions on here. I mean, really, I've not been very impressed with what Obama has done so far. I mean, really, we've seen a very, very conservative presidency under him. I mean, his health care, as Arun just mentioned, was drafted after the Massachusetts bill by Mitt Romney. And what it does is it forces American citizens to buy privatized health care, which is so far from the public option that so many Democrats wanted. So it's my personal theory that we haven't seen good Republican presidential candidates simply because the Republicans are pretty happy with the situation. I mean, I see it. They really kick up a fuss every time Obama does something, but I think Obama's just their scapegoat. Obama does something very Republican, and then when we have to bear all the issues and problems resulting from it, the Republicans just come out and say it's Obama's fault, when really inside they're just smiling and grinning at the situation.
An interesting thing with Romney Care, actually, is that it was designed not necessarily to force health care upon people, but actually provide health care for those who didn't have it. So Romney's plan was actually more effective than Obama's, because the only people he was affecting were people in Massachusetts without health care, which was something like less than 5%. So really what he was doing is forcing people to buy health care that needed health care, whereas Obama is just forcing people to buy healthcare from private companies that don't necessarily want healthcare, don't need it, and possibly could lose money and even their jobs or their houses and things like that because they don't have any spare money.
So you think there's, you know, a line being drawn between how much power government has over a person's private finances and how they want to manage their money. I mean, personally, I think that if a person wants to buy healthcare, it's their own personal decision that shouldn't be a government decision to make for them. And I feel that it's a bit of an infringement on a person and the individuality. And yeah.
Well, kind of to shift the topic here, I'd like to talk a bit more about super PACs. We mentioned them earlier in the show, mm-hmm. and they're a pretty huge deal now. I mean, if anybody's watched the Colbert Report, you have got some pretty funny criticisms on super PACs there. And what a super PAC is it's a committee organized supposedly independently of a candidate. And what happens is it has very, very weak laws on how money can be spent, how much money can be spent, and how much money they can receive. And what we've seen is they have this non-coordination clause that specifies that a super PAC manager cannot coordinate with any politician. However, it's an absolute farce because we see things such as Newt Gingrich and Mitt Romney communicating to their super PAC through press releases. I mean, really what they say is, we'd like to advertise in New Hampshire because we think that'd be an important place to advertise. And then their super PAC picks up the message, sees nods and winks involved, and then advertises in New Hampshire for them.
Not only that, but the candidates are asked directly, what do you think that your super PAC is going to do? And they say, I don't believe that my super PAC, and basically they're acknowledging the fact that they have a super PAC, and everyone's just, that's just a fact of life. And on top of that, there's non-disclosure clauses, like, until recently, we didn't know who was contributing
January
to them.
January 1st, I believe.
Yeah.
And, really, I think this whole issue of money is causing an absolute mess, because the way I see it is, in a good democracy, every single person has only one vote. Just one. And the problem is, when someone has all this money and they can donate to the super PACs, they don't have one vote anymore. I mean, they potentially have thousands and millions of votes in the way they can influence people with their ads and TV time. And I think the European solution so far is pretty good because, I mean, really what they've done is said that they're going to even the field as much as possible with their free ads with equal representation. What they've done is said, well, we really don't care how much money each politician has. That doesn't matter to us. So we'll give every single politician equal representation for free.
And something that I'm really a big proponent of is shortening the election process, and I'd like to hear what you guys have to say on that, and then I'll finish up with my own opinion. But do you think a shorter election would cause the candidates to be more honest with their spewings, I suppose?
Well, I don't know. I'm a little on the fence with this one, because I feel it is very important for the people to find out as much as possible about politicians, and a longer election cycle, I certainly feel, allows for that. But also, this long election cycle has really turned it into kind of a media circus. So I'm really not sure which way I fall on that one. Haron, do you want to tell us what you think?
I think that we've seen through this election, I mean, the Citizens United versus the FEC really opened up the door to ads. And we also saw in the 2006 election of, I think it was a Swift Voters Act where they bashed on Kerry. And, I mean, it's all about the timing on when it's going to be. And that ad particularly released, I think a month before the general election. So I think that what Casey's saying and what they're doing in Europe is very sound, of giving every candidate an amount of time to represent themselves and say what they believe. And as to the process, I think 4 years, and I mean, typically you'll say it's about 2 years, 3 years, because the first year isn't really, they don't have anything to really do about that. But I think that 4 years is fair. And I just really think that we need to change the way that they're given money to be able to put themselves out, because we're not hearing enough about the candidates themselves. They're just bringing out the flaws of their competitors instead of talking about themselves. So that's what, as a constituent, I want to know. Who are you? What do you stand for? And what are you going to do for this country? And what is backing you up? Do you have a history of doing things and changing things? Casey?
And also, not who you've slept with. I mean, that's not much of an interest of mine. I don't care about Herman Cain's sex life or anything like that. I just want to hear what he wants to do about Libya, which, by the way, he doesn't even know exists.
Yeah, but when you look at the president represents a country. And when you're electing someone to represent an entire country, I think even though you might say it's no one's business, his personal relationships and things like that, but in reality, in the international scale, it is. Because people look at that and see the character of the president. I mean, if you have Herman Cain having affairs, you have Newt Gingrich wanting an open marriage and so forth, it's going to get tricky there.
Make America look bad. I see that point.
Yeah.
Yeah, and in conclusion, my own opinion is pretty simply that the election process is so long that it basically kills the fourth year of the president, who is the incumbent in the situation, and that really isn't fair to the country, because as a whole, not only is it distracting from the actual issues, it's completely taking the power away from the president, because he has to go campaign, whereas he could be in the White House making decisions and getting things done. And I would like to see there be some way for us to get an honest candidate that was not a complete scumbag, but that doesn't always happen. And really, I think that we should shorten the term of the president and make the election shorter. And so have like 2 years for one president and then maybe a 2 week, 3 week campaign kind of deal. Because really what they get done is within a 2 year span of time. And that's usually what we think of, is those 2 years where they were effective.
Well, if you look at it, 2 years is not a lot of time. I mean, when the president first gets into office, he's got, you could say, popular support. So I guess you could say that's the time when he's pushing his agenda and the changes that he's going to make. And we saw with Obama, he tried doing that, and he had the support, but then it got overruled, and then he started losing popularity. But at the same time, this whole year has been, Obama hasn't really been doing much. He just gave his State of the Union address criticizing Congress and what they're doing, and he made a reference to the Army and how the Army isn't worried about politics, about honors and things like that. They're just worried about getting the mission done. And he called Congress to do the same, to stop worrying about winning a Republican or Democratic House of Representatives or having the majority, but rather solving the issues that are important to the United States. One could say, you know, right now the biggest one is money and how we're going to be reducing the budget and things like that.
Well, some things I'd like to say is, on Obama's State of the Union address, I really didn't like his military comments, because really, if you look at the military, if it were a political system, it would be a dictatorship. I mean, I'm all in support of the system of our military, but it really can't be compared to any political process because it is managed so differently. In the military, cooperation is more important than the actual actions. Yet, in our government, the actual actions are just of tantamount importance, because that is what leads our country. And I'd kind of like to speak out against bipartisanship here. I mean, I've really seen it thrown about in the media as this huge buzzword, as family values was a couple decades ago. I really think that's silly. I mean, in my view, Republicans aren't really looking out for the average people that much. They're looking out for their special interests, and I really don't believe in working together with these people if all these people want to do is bad. Unfortunately, we're in a situation where we have to because they're now taking the majorities. I mean, I'm really upset with Obama for not taking his majorities in the House and Senate in the beginning of his term and using them. I think bipartisanship, compromising with the bad guys, isn't really going to work out too well for us. I mean, really, we've seen nothing but compromise on Obama's part. I don't want to see bipartisanship. I want to see piss and vinegar. I believe it was Teddy Roosevelt, I may be wrong there, but he was the piss and vinegar candidate, and he got things done with that.
And I would like to point out that we really need to limit the effects of lobbyists and corporations in our presidential campaigns and pretty much everything to do with our politics. It's kind of invasive, and it really distorts the political process and corrupts our candidates as well as our nation as a whole.
Well, I think that goes back to the Citizens United versus FEC. And now they have a large, you could say, a vote, like Casey was saying, that they have even millions of votes. But, I mean, dealing to the corruption of what, you know, Washington, D.C. has been having, and, you know, you could say the, I think it was insider trading,
yeah,
that, you know, members of Congress will be on a committee, and they'll have insider information of what's going to happen with the economy, stock markets, and then they'll go and tell their stockbroker to invest or take their money out of a certain account. And I think that's one of the problems right now that's happening. And, I'd like to see a law about that.
I mean, it's really like the senators are in it for the money. I mean, I forget what the exact percentage is. It may have been around 70%. I could be wrong there, but I believe it was about 70% of senators gross over $1 million. This isn't a job about fixing the country. This is a job about filling your pockets.
Yeah. You know, we saw, I think it was, I don't remember his name, but he was a member of Congress, and right after he left, he became a lobbyist, and I mean, from going to Congress and being a lobbyist, you know how everything's working, and you know how to push your agenda as a lobbyist, and that's one of the things that, you know, I would like to have as well. I mean, if you're a member of Congress, after you retire from Congress or you're not voted in, you can't be a lobbyist. That's one of the things that is heavily affecting the corruption in Washington, D.C.
And, the lobbyist thing really needs to be fixed in some way, shape, or form. We really haven't taken enough attention to that issue. But I would like to discuss third-party candidates and their effectiveness in the political climate. I personally think that they don't have that much of an effect other than actually getting their own ideas incorporated into one party or another. And I believe that a vote for a third-party candidate is indeed throwing a vote away simply because they will not get elected.
I actually think that it's not a vote thrown away. I think it's giving a vote. If you're voting for a third party that is offering a new idea, for example, in 2000 we had the Ralph Nader, who had the environmentalist view, I believe. So by voting for Ralph Nader, the other political parties are seeing that there's a call for the environmentalism. So then the next time they're going to be up for election, they're going to have to incorporate that if they want those people to vote for them. It's actually calling for a change in the way that they're running their own parties.
Speaking of third parties, let's talk about Ron Paul. He's currently running under the Republican ticket, but he truly isn't a Republican. I mean, he's openly a Libertarian, which is a different party. And I'm not necessarily for Ron Paul, but what I've really seen is absolutely no attention given to him. And it's really strange how the media focuses on things, because I feel Ron Paul is the lesser of evils here on the Republican end.
It was very interesting to see in South Carolina, which was a heavily militant, I guess, really they're pro-military, that he was the only military veteran up there, and he'd received the least attention from not only the media, but the crowd as well. While he did receive some very open, like, they asked for him to speak, they didn't seem to give him too much attention. There wasn't very much cheering for him. And I think that Ron Paul's really gotten the short end of the stick, because I personally do support him as compared to the other candidates, because he's pretty no BS. And like I said, I don't like corporations. But I would like to, yeah.
I think it'd be really interesting to see how different our elections would be now with the European system, because, I mean, there everybody would get equal commercial representation and so on. So, I mean, imagine an election campaign where Ron Paul was given a bit more of a space here. I mean, it'd be a completely different candidacy and debate system where Ron Paul got as much representation as, say, Rick Perry. I mean, really, you see some more electable candidates like Ron Paul. He's definitely not the most electable, but certainly more than, I'd say, Herman Cain, and you see absolutely no attention given to him.
Well, I think it's ironic because you have Ron Paul, who's, I mean, you could say is slightly radical. I mean, libertarians want, he says,
legalize,
I believe,
drugs.
Yes, yeah. Legalize drugs and things like that.
But don't deal them.
But don't deal them. And then you have Rick Perry, Mitt Romney, and all the other guys. But it seems like this year's been highly controversial. I mean, at first it was Herman Cain with his, I think it was 2020.
999. Rick Perry,
and then Rick
was
Perry
2020.
Was 2020. And so then they're just going out with the craziest things, the strong campaigns. So it's more of an entertainment thing now. It's not about being elected. It's about who can make, I guess you could say, the United States laugh the most. You have Herman Cain quoting the Pokemon movie. I mean, what is this country coming to when someone who is seriously being considered for presidency is quoting a children's movie?
I mean, the only reason I can think of for them to draw so much attention to themselves, basically just to drop out of the race, is to get interest in the Republican Party as a whole. Because what they're all doing is they're dropping out and they're immediately giving their support to Mitt Romney. It's what's happened to most of the candidates that have dropped out and then just gone in support of that candidate.
Well, I'd really like to criticize the media a little more here because I'd like to see the media to act a lot more of a fact-checking organization. I mean, at this point, they just kind of throw the Republican candidates in a room and watch them get at each other's throats. Why not have the media come out and look at each comment by, say, Newt Gingrich or Mitt Romney or whoever, and do their best as a third-party organization to analyze the statements and to look at the arguments, and if there's bald-faced lies, which there most certainly are in these elections, then they should address them and criticize them as a completely separate entity.
Well, the one that sticks out in my head is actually Rick Perry, and I think it was on NBC or something like that, but he was saying that if he became president, he would cut out three of the
organizations and the EPA.
Yeah, and then he mentioned education as the third, which I found, I mean, extremely dumb, because if you're cutting down on education, I mean, that's the future of the United States. Why would you want to do that? You sound ridiculous on national TV, going against what you could say most people in the United States want more of. Here in California, we're experiencing massive budget cuts on the educational system. All three of us are going to be heading to some type of college. And, I mean, there's no point in going to college if you're going to come out with $100,000 of debt. We'd like to have more money contributed to educating people who are better than Herman Cain quoting the Pokemon movie.
Not only that, though, on the Perry thing, he was actually given the answer to that question by another candidate. I believe it was Gingrich, actually, because he froze on national TV and could not remember exactly what he was going to say, and Gingrich just gave him his plan for him, and the other candidates just smiled.
Well, I'd like to bring it back to education. I'm going to throw in my own personal opinions on politics here again, but I really feel we should tackle our current recession in a completely different manner. I mean, I'm reading through an economics college textbook right now simply because I do like economics. I'm actually interested in becoming a politician. But in big, bold, highlighted letters in one of my chapters on national debt and deficit, it says that attempts to fix the budget during recession will prolong and deepen the recession. And that is really what we've seen the Republican candidates focus on, is balancing the budget. And the way I see this is, it's like trying to fix your house mortgage while working $8 an hour. Isn't it a better idea to invest, say, a year in getting a $16 an hour job and then pay off your mortgage? I mean, right now we shouldn't be focusing on fixing the debt. That is for a time of prosperity when we have surpluses. Though debt is a bad thing, the most important thing right now is getting the jobs necessary to fix this debt. And the only way we can do that is by investing in education, by investing in research, and by investing in businesses, not by investing in cuts and throwing these massive budget cuts at our rapidly growing deficit.
I'd have to agree with Casey. I think what he's heading towards is in the 1940s, 1930s, we saw the New Deal program by FDR, and he actually, I mean, he took out loans to to be able to create jobs for Americans. And I mean, once you start circulating money, people start buying more, and if they have more money, the companies are making more products, and it's just a cycle of rebuilding and making the economy start running again. And as Casey was saying, it's an investment. You're not going to be seeing results for the exact moment when you create the new jobs. It's going to take 4, 5, 6 years. But what matters is that you're going to be changing it. It's going to be an investment that's going to matter. In 6 years, you're going to see the economy get better, growing, growing, growing. Of course, you could say that in that time, it was the war that really helped us out. You know, you had the other countries buying our goods, and that really pulled us out of the recession as well.
One thing I'd like to mention is, I believe it was 7 times under the Reagan administration that the debt ceiling was raised. So, I mean, you really see the Republicans, whose god or demigod is Ronald Reagan, going on about how terrible it is that Obama's raised the debt ceiling. But, I mean, you really got to consider, I mean, is that really a practical criticism?
And I would just like to mention that our budget is a little ridiculous on the military side. We still have bases over in the Asian Pacific Islands, and we basically just camped out there for, what, 50 years now? Something like that? We've just been throwing money into keeping soldiers in these areas just to keep a watchful eye, and that's a little wasteful.
So I think that Obama's actually heading towards that. He's actually begun the process of removing most of the troops from the Afghanistan area and bringing them back home because, you know, in truth, that those wars made a huge debt, and we contributed tons of money into that. And that's one of the major things that if once we start recovering that money again to use towards recovering the economy, it's going to be a lot better than being involved in international policemen.
Now, we have a classmate, a mutual classmate, I'm sure all of you guys will know who it is, but I mean, he often says, money doesn't grow on trees, referring to entitlement programs and such, and asking for budget cuts. I said, yes, you're right, money doesn't grow on trees, so let's end the costly wars. And I mean, I really think that's something we gotta look at. I mean, yeah, money doesn't grow on trees, but I mean, we gotta have these things. I mean, you can't just throw everything out and assume that we're still gonna be a great country. How many budget cuts before we start calling ourselves a third world country?
I would also like to bring up the subject of jobs. We really don't have enough jobs in this country, and there's a lot of benefits going to the military people and things like that, and I think that's a great idea, but we should focus more on trying to get everyone a job, not necessarily getting this person or that person a job. And we really haven't gotten that much of a focus on jobs and education, because really what's going to end up happening is the other countries will catch us in education and things like that, because they actually, China sends their students over to America to get an American education, then sends them back to do things like steal German railroads and completely mass produce what used to be a $10,000 thing, now costs the Chinese about $20.
I mean, it's kind of like our best education is going to foreigners. I mean, not to be hard on foreigners, but I mean, we gotta take advantage of our own education system. And I mean, something I'd like to say is just to attack the trickle-down theory. I mean, it's just an absolute joke. A trickle-down theory used to be a pretty big buzzword, and it kind of disappeared because of bias against it, I think fair bias. But really, trickle-down theory is still here. It's still in practice, and we've just given it the new name of supply-side economics. It's the exact same thing. It's this bizarre concept that you can give money to the wealthy, and then the wealthy will fairly and accurately distribute that money to the lower classes, and I think that's just downright backwards. We have given so many tax cuts to the rich, and especially the extension of the Bush-era tax cuts, and it's absurd. What we need to do is take this money that we've let the rich just absolutely stockpile en masse and invest in foreign investments, and take that money and give it to our education so the lower classes can become the upper classes and give everybody a chance.
And I think it's pretty interesting that the people who get the most money in the United States, the top 1%, have the lowest taxes. And I'm not necessarily saying we should give them more taxes than the rest of the American people, but it would be great if they had the same amount, because 20% of so many billion dollars is quite a bit more than 20% of 10,000.
Yeah, I agree. I actually want to have more taxes on the rich. It's absurd. They have millions, millions, and millions of dollars, but yet they're just stockpiling it, which is what Casey was heading towards. Recently, there was a millionaire I don't remember
Warren
his name.
Buffett.
Warren Buffett, exactly. So he actually gave a large contribution directly to the government to be able to, you know, donate towards fixing the economy. And he also has been calling to arms all the other millionaires to do the same. I mean, as Americans, I think that that's one of their duties. I mean, if you have a surplus of money, I mean, Bill Gates, he has billions of dollars. Does he really need $1 billion for the rest of his life? He could probably spend $1,000 a day for the rest of his life, and he could still have $1 billion.
I'd hate to cut off this topic of conversation, but we're going to open up the phone lines now. And the phone number is 707-456-9991. Three nines, just like Herman Cain. Everyone is welcome to call, and we'd especially like to encourage the youth in the listening audience. Please call in if you have questions or insights about the political climate today. Do you think that our election process works well? Do you think that there is too much money influencing our political campaigns? How do you feel about the super PACs opening the door to unlimited funding of negative ads that candidates can deny responsibility for? And as we've kind of strayed from the original topic, you can also talk to us about our current political opinions we've expressed. And do you think our political campaigns are too long? If you were going to change one thing about how we elect our leaders, what would it be? What do you think of the European models of campaign restrictions? How about the Electoral Congress rather than the popular vote determining presidential elections? Have you ever voted for a third-party candidate? Did you think you were throwing your vote away? Have you ever been involved in a political campaign? What did you do and what did you learn from the experience? What advice would you give to first-time voters? The phone number is 707-456-9991. Remember Herman Cain. When you call, please be ready to turn down your radio or we'll get a very confusing echo. The number is 456-9991. Please call and be part of this discussion. We'd really like to hear from you.
Caller, you're on the air.
Well, hi. I just want to comment and say thank you for this program and you guys taking the time to speak up and sharing your ideas and opinions. I personally, after the Supreme Court said corporations can spend whatever they want, it's over, you guys.
Yeah.
It's over.
For the most part.
The idea of the Constitution has been getting been used as teepee.
I think it's kind of a weird situation, actually, because I believe there actually was a clause somewhere in the Constitution, now I could be entirely wrong, that actually kind of hinted at corporations being people, and I think the issue here is we're taking these vague clauses in the Constitution that are 200 plus years old, and we're just distorting them to an entirely different world. I mean, you really can't take these.
I believe it was the 14th Amendment.
Yeah.
The idea was that the Constitution was referring to white people only.
Uh-huh.
So they amended, saying, hey, it means black people too. Black people
that's
have
the 15th.
Rights. And they, on that amendment, tagged on there, and corporations have rights to people as well.
Uh-huh. And, I mean, that may have been completely legitimate at the time, and I believe there were some reasons to that. I'd have to look it up and research it more, and perhaps ask my government teacher. But it seems like this is a clause that's really gone way past its time. And, I mean, we're in a completely different world these days, and we really need to rethink these things and perhaps go back and fix them.
So that's the big thing right now, is do we amend the Constitution and put another amendment saying corporations are not people? That's the big hoopla right now. That's the big push right now. Move to amend is all about it.
Uh-huh. Well, thank you for your time. Let's move on to the next caller. Please call in, and I'll remind you the number is 456-9991. We're looking for your opinions, and we'd like anybody from any side of the political spectrum.
I'd like to just say that I don't think that necessarily that is... It could be in the Constitution, but I don't think that said that. I think it would be more beneficial if we just had a Supreme Court ruling on that.
Caller, you're on the air.
Yes, I'd like to make a comment about the mandate that all must have insurance.
Mm-hmm.
If you get smashed in the street and taken to the emergency room, you will get medical care, whether you have a penny or not.
Mm-hmm.
And the cost of that is borne by those who buy insurance premiums and by government programs that have to supplement the hospital to keep it alive. So I'm calling to say that I support the idea of everybody being required to have insurance because it spreads the risk out, especially the young who are not going to need any medical services to speak of. That's how the thing is funded. The big mistake was not having a public option so that we're forced into the jaws of the...
Oh, I agree with that wholeheartedly, definitely. I feel that the issue here is not that everybody needs to have insurance. The issue here is that who gives that insurance? I mean...
Absolutely.
I kind of see health insurance companies as casinos. You're betting on your health, and the house always wins.
But I think it's important to have the two issues. One is, yes, everybody should have insurance for the reasons I just outlined, but obviously if there's no public option, then we're at the mercy of the corporations, and they can charge whatever they want.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Anyway, great show, and I like hearing such articulate and well-informed young people.
Thank you very much.
And one thing I'd just like to throw in there are other countries that have medical care for much, much cheaper than the United States of America, and they also happen to have free insurance. Caller, you're on the air.
No.
The number again, my bad. The number again is 456-9991.
All right. I think this system where everybody is going to have to pay for a privatized healthcare system is just bogus. And I'd like for everybody out there just to explain really quick what exactly the public option is. We've mentioned it a couple times. It is where the government can compete with private organizations for offering healthcare.
Caller, you're on the air.
Hi, I just joined the conversation, and I wanted to add my voice about the issue of the Constitution. There are a lot of us who are absolutely tired of seeing blatant human rights abuses by this country and by every other country. And I just wanted for us to remember that the Constitution was given to us by our founding fathers, not because our government or any government can grant our rights to free speech and decent living conditions, but because we as human beings have those rights, and the government exists to protect them. When they do not protect them, they are in dereliction of duty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I really wanted to say.
Thanks a lot, and I definitely agree with you. I mean, it's a pretty strong issue, and I kind of see that as in support of entitlement programs. I mean, it takes a lot of attack from Republicans claiming that people have this false sense of entitlement, but I'd say, I mean, they're human beings. Let's have some compassion here. Let's give human beings a quality of life deserving to a human being.
I agree. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So that number is 456-9991, and we'd really love to hear from you.
Caller, you're on the air.
I just wanted to find public option. It was not where the federal government would compete with private health care providers. It had only to do with funding.
Sorry on that one. Could you please give us some more explanation?
Yeah, it would be a federal insurance plan competing with the private insurance plans. That's why it was so resisted. And Medicare is administered with a cost of about 3% of gross proceeds, whereas the insurance industry wastes about 20% on their conventions in the Bahamas and whatnot. So we know that all this business about government inefficiency is nothing compared to corporate inefficiency.
Uh-huh.
So if there were a public option in this health care bill, which there should have been, then it would have said, okay, you can buy your insurance either from one of the private providers who would then be forced to be competitive, or from the federal plan, which would mean lower overhead, and obviously it would drive prices down.
Thanks a lot for clarifying that for us.
The health care would be provided by the same doctors in the same hospitals, and that wouldn't change.
The government's not going to get between you and your doctor, and I think that's just a very silly buzzword the Republicans were throwing around for a while, that somehow the government's going to step in and somehow dictate unfairly how you're going to get your care.
Well, yeah, when the person said, do you want some government bureaucrat making decisions about your health care? And I said, hell yes, rather than some corporate CEO yeah. whose pocket's going to be lined by the decision he makes.
Really, the way I see it is, I mean, there's some things in life that are just so incredibly important that you can't trust them to the quote-unquote invisible hand of the market, and you can't trust them to corporate profits. Like, I believe the police force operates that way. I mean, it's so important that we have police protection that we can't put it in the hands of corporate profit, and we can't expect the invisible hand to step in for us, because the invisible hand doesn't act quote-unquote morally and doesn't work on moral grounds. It works on money. I mean, these things are so morally charged that we can't leave it to money to decide how they operate.
And one thing with the
public option. I'm going to get off the phone so you guys can continue.
Okay, all right. Thank you.
One thing that I'd like to say about the public option is that was one of the things that I really would like to have seen lobbying restricted on, because really that was the only reason that public option wasn't in there, is because of pharmaceutical lobbyists.
And one really important thing I think we should note is when Obamacare first started getting off the ground, and we saw it emerge as it did as a way to force people to buy privatized healthcare, stocks on privatized healthcare rose. I mean, really, I think that's all you need to know about this bill, is that healthcare stocks went up.
Corruption.
Money is worth more than health.
Why did they go up?
They went up because people would be forced to buy privatized healthcare, and that means, I mean, what company wouldn't want a captive consumer?
Caller, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to say how impressed I am with the agenda that you guys have come up with, and it makes you sound like the grown-ups and the politicians sound like the teenagers. And I think especially you, Casey, who aspires to be a politician yourself, that your platform, your agenda, was born today. And I'm so proud of all of you.
Thank you very much. Now, that's all for this month's edition of You Speaks Out. Your hosts today have been me, Casey, and...
Aron.
And me, Elwin.
Laytonville Healthy Start Coalition Drug-Free Communities Project is proud to support this month's You Speaks Out. Our Environmental Prevention Strategies in the Community, also known as EPIC, is a project funded by the Office of National Drug Control Policy. Through our organization and coalition, we are working towards reducing youth substance abuse through a variety of strategies in the Laytonville community. If you are interested in learning more about our efforts, please contact Laytonville Healthy Start at 707-984-8089 or email Jama at jamashields@pacific.net.
You Speaks Out is produced and directed by Dan Roberts, who may be reached by mail at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California 95490, or through the website www.youspeaksout.net. There you can find out more information about the project, get addresses for contacting us, get a copy of a show, and listen to many hours of previous programs in streaming audio. The views expressed on this program are not necessarily those of KZYX. They are the views of those who express them,